You're listening to
Cat Tales. Hi, I'm Kat and you're listening to Cat Tales. When the punk revolution took hold in the 70s, Stiff Little Fingers were at the forefront of the movement, along with the likes of The Clash, Sex Pistols, The Jam, The Buzzcocks, Undertones, Sham 69, The Stranglers, Need I Go On. But the band of four from Belfast defined something a little bit more than simple rebellion. Writing about their own lives growing up at the height of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, they confronted social change head-on, and with songs like Suspect Device and Wasted Life, they took on the establishment and won. 40 years on, Stiff Little Fingers are still out there touring, but this time they're talking to a whole new generation and still creating meaningful music. This is The One with Jake Burns.
Got Jake from Stiff Little Fingers on the line, and whereabouts are you?
At the moment, I'm in Bristol.
You're in Bristol, sunny Bristol, hopefully.
Actually, it isn't too bad today at all. It was pouring with rain yesterday, but it's actually not bad today.
Oh, that's good. Now, you are obviously frontman and guitarist of the legendary Stiff Little Fingers, and you're on the 40th anniversary tour.
That's right, yeah, 40 years. It doesn't seem... It's strange. You know, sometimes it seems like it's the blink of an eye, and other times it's... I can't remember a time before it, you know?
Yes, it's a strange thing, isn't it? I mean, many bands don't even make 40 months, do they? Let alone 40 years. Does it feel surreal?
Yeah, I mean, you know, also, not only, you know, the fact that it's been so long, but, you know, we've kind of done it without any sort of real mainstream success. You know, we've not sort of, you know... We weren't sort of regulars on Top of the Pops back in the day or anything like that. And,
no.
You know, so we've basically lasted this long simply because our audience has been so loyal, you know. I mean, I've basically all compared them more to a football crowd than a rock band audience. Just a bit like, you know, once you've adopted your football team, they're your football team for life. And you know, our audience are a bit like that. You know, once they're Stiff Little Fingers fans, they're lifers in general. You know,
that's great, though, isn't it? That's exactly what you want, to be honest, isn't it? Because then they hopefully grow with you as well, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very flattering, like I said, and not a little bit humbling as well, that people have actually invested so much of their time in the band. And, you know, I mean, they come along, they've got the band's name and logos tattooed on them. They bring their families with them. You know, if you think back to when the whole punk rock thing happened in the UK and in Ireland back in the mid to late 70s, you know, the very thought of it being a family evening out would never have occurred to you at all. And yet, and that's exactly what it is, you know.
Oh, that's terrific there, isn't it, really? You know, the second generation punks, they come of age, don't they? Isn't that wonderful?
Yes, it's fantastic. I mean, you know, and obviously that's contributed to the longevity and continued success of the band. You know, in fact, if anything, we're playing to bigger audiences that probably... Well, maybe not quite at the band's complete height, but we're getting close to it again, you know, and that's gratifying. And as I said before, you know, not more than a little humbling as well after all this time.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. I mean, I suppose the challenge for you, Jake, is going to be how do you keep it fresh after all these years? And, you know, what more do you have to offer? And how do you actually come about, you know, trying to get something that's going to be a little bit different for them?
Well, you know, basically, I've always said all along that I've never been terribly good at writing love songs. I mean, it's not something that comes easily to me. Anytime I try to do it, it always comes out like bad sixth form poetry. So, you know, I tend to steer clear of that. I mean, generally when I'm writing songs, I write about things that upset my sense of justice and what kind of should be right with the world. And, you know, over the years, there's certainly been no shortage of inspiration for that. And at the moment, if anything, it's, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I find distasteful. You know, I mean, so it's not difficult to find things to write about. And I think that, you know, that coupled with the fact that, as I mentioned, you know, we never really became rock stars in the accepted sense of the term. You know, we never made so much money that we were completely divorced from everyday life. I mean, I think that, you know, the home lives of all of the guys in the band are probably very, very similar to the majority of our audience, which means that, you know, things that affect our everyday lives affect theirs as well. So, I mean, for example, in, you know, the last major recession, my wife lost her job. As a consequence of which we lost our apartment. We had to, I love the modern term, we had to downsize, which basically means you're broke, so you have to buy a smaller place, you know. And, you know, so we had to go through that. And, you know, and lots of people did. And I yeah. think, you know, the fact that we were able to write songs that reflected that, it strikes a chord with a lot of our audience. And that's one of the reasons that they're still there, you know.
Yeah, sure. I can totally relate to that. You're notorious for your political statements, though, aren't you? Despite the fact, obviously, you're talking about what has happened in your life. And, of course, politics yeah. and the state of the country or the state of the world affect everybody. So,
sure.
I mean, do you have a bias towards actually making a statement and really leading the way and trying to actually say, you know, things can get better or be that rebellious, young, youthful band that you were? Is that still in your blood?
I think, you know, I mean, obviously we grew up in Northern Ireland through the whole troubles and the civil unrest there. So I think that, you know, coming from that background, you can't help but be politically motivated. That really is your everyday life. Mm. And, you know, that's something that certainly shaped all four of us when we started the band. I mean, obviously now there's just myself and Ali left in that original lineup. But,
yeah.
you know, I think once that does get into your system, then, you know, you are always looking for something that's better, something that's fairer, something that's more equal. And, mm-hmm. You know, we always tried to veer away from party politics, although you wouldn't have to scratch too deeply on the surface of our lyrics to see exactly where my sympathies would lie. But, you know, I've tried never to be a hectoring presence on stage. I've tried never to stand up there and give political speeches. And I certainly don't have any solutions to the problems. I mean, if I did have the solutions, then, you know, I would probably be a politician rather than a musician. I mean, I see my role as a songwriter very much just as holding a mirror up to society and pointing these things out and saying, look, this is happening. I don't think it's right, but how do you feel about it? What can we do to fix it? You know, I like I said, I don't have the answers. I just sort of see ourselves as pointing these things out. And, you know, again, I think from that point of view, then, you know, we've been reasonably successful. And, you know, if nothing else, it sparks debate. And I think, you know, the more people talk about problems, the more chance you have of finding a solution to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that debate is a really important point, isn't it? Especially in today's sort of day and age when there's a lot going on, as you alluded to earlier. But looking back to those early days when obviously, it's, you know, punk was about rebellion, did you ever have a sense of the subject matter that you were talking about, you know, Belfast and the Northern Ireland troubles and sectarianism, etc.? Did you have a sense that, you know, actually, oh, do you know what, this may not be a good idea. I could be setting myself up for, you know, for a fall or at the very, you know, the very worst, some danger?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, obviously, you know, you were aware that was a possibility. But I don't think, again, you know, had we, again, achieved sort of U2 success or whatever, then I think we'd have probably been in more danger of you know, attracting unwanted attention. I think in general, like I said, simply because we adopted, a reflective sense, a reflective stance on it, and, you know, just basically said, this is what's happening, held a mirror up to it. We were viewed more as almost as like a sort of a journalistic, you know, sort of a rock and roll form of journalism almost. And I think also, you know, again, both sides equally adopted and rejected us as their own, you know. So, like, you know, we never set out to say one side was right and the other side was wrong. Okay. We basically said, you know, that, you know, all this violence was effectively sort of curtailing everybody's normal life over there. And it was actually the means to the end rather than either end that we were criticising.
Yeah, sure. I mean, looking back to something like Inflammable Material, your, you know, first album, you know, straight out there, you know, got the backing of John Peel, which is great. You know, now it's looked back on as being one of, you know, punk's landmark and angry albums. But at the time, did it feel like you were actually making a defining moment in history, or was it just something you wanted to do?
No, I mean, and I don't think anybody feels that way when they make a record. Certainly not making your first record. I mean, your first record is basically just the chance to chronicle what you've done up to that point. And the other thing to bear in mind with regards to Inflammable Material was we hadn't got a record contract when we made it. I mean, we made it with Rough Trade, who very kindly stepped in and said, you know, we'd just finished supporting the Tom Robinson Band around the UK, and we were convinced we would get a record deal off the back of that, but no major label came forward. And the guys from Australia basically said to us, look, you know, we've released Alternative Ulster for you. We've never made an album. You've never made an album. Why don't we make it together and see how it goes? So, you know, it was done very much on a handshake. And so as far as we were concerned, it was just basically a chance to record those songs for posterity, if you like, because, again, as things stood at that time, with no ongoing record contract, for all we knew, that was the only record we were ever going to get to make. So it was just a case of, you know, well, this is something you can play to your grandchildren and say, this is what granddad did when he was young and foolish, you know. So,
yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, obviously, like you said, I mean, the Peel support was vital, absolutely vital, not just for us, but for, you know, a million bands going back as far as Pink Floyd, you know, in the 60s. So, you know, I think that once we'd gotten that and the press interest we were getting on the tour, and then, of course, the album was a success. So that's, you know, suddenly then we find ourselves from being in the position of, well, we've made this record, we've recorded those songs, maybe this is the end of it, to, you know, suddenly then we did have a record contract and it was an ongoing thing, you know.
Yeah, and it's only when you look back, isn't it, that you see, actually, that was quite an important moment, you know, and you don't know those moments at the time, do you?
Which, yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I don't think anybody realises, you know, just how momentous certain things can be. It is, like you said, only when you look back you think, certainly in our career, that was huge.
Yeah. I mean, if you're looking back and just thinking other things in retrospect, have there been other specific moments that now you look back and you go, do you know, that was one there? I mean, it might have been last week, for example, but there was a moment. Is there anything that springs to mind?
The only thing that always comes back to me is, well, at the time, how just inevitable we all felt it was. I mean, we all felt that, you know, okay, this is what happens when you're, you know, I think we'd probably watched too many episodes of The Monkees or something when we were kids. So it's like, you know, we all felt that, you know, this is how it works. You form a band, you make a record, it goes into the charts, you go on tour, that's how it works. Of course, you know, looking back on it now, you realise that hundreds of bands form and sometimes never even get to make a record. And if they do, it doesn't necessarily go into the charts and they don't necessarily get to go on tour. And yeah, I think, you know, and also at the time, it seemed to us to take forever. Everything seemed so slow.
Yeah.
But again, looking back on it, the time scale was, you know, we formed the band in April 1977. We released the first single in March 1978, and we were in the charts in February 1979 as, like, you know, the highest new entry in the album chart.
Yeah, and whirlwind, really.
So it was a whirlwind, you know, but it didn't feel like it at the time.
No.
And I think not so much looking back and think of things as momentous. I look back and think of things as, God, how lucky were we? I mean, you know, the number of times that you find yourself in the right place at the right time and in the right company. And, you know, for all that to sort of just, you know, serendipitously fall into place at that time was, you know, beyond reason, really. I mean, you couldn't plan it. And I think that's something, you know, when I try to talk to people about, you know, how do you make a career in the music business? I really don't know. And certainly these days, I really wouldn't know. I mean, but the one thing you really cannot overlook is luck. I mean, I know, and I know more and more of them as time goes on. I know more and more phenomenal musicians, much better musicians than any of the four of us are, who are literally sort of scrambling to see where their next gig's going to come from. And it's, you know, that's nothing to do with their talent. It's nothing to do with their creativity, and it's nothing to do with their musicianship. It's pure dumb luck, you know.
Yeah, music industry doesn't take any prisoners, does it, really? And you're absolutely right. And I've spoken to so many people in your position and musicians who are really still enjoying a career of 40 years, which is remarkable. And other people, as you say, who just fall by the wayside, and it's brutal, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
I saw that actually you'd done a pledge campaign, hadn't you? So, I mean, do you think that that's been quite useful in terms of trying to utilise new tools that weren't available before?
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole pledge campaign things. We've done two of them now. I mean, they're both very steep learning curves. We thought we'd learned a lot from the first one, and we ended up making a whole bunch of different mistakes on the second one. It's a steep learning curve, because you're basically taking on every job involved in making a record. You know, you have to organize the studio, you have to organize the producers, although we produce it ourselves, but you have to organize the engineers, you have to organize the pressing, you have to organize the artwork, you have to organize the distribution. And it's, you know, suddenly it's an awful lot of work on your part, but it is also incredibly freeing on the other side, because you are a completely independent business. Obviously, it's reliant on the goodwill of the audience to buy the product in advance, if you like. I tend to try and think of it as just sort of pre-ordering an album rather than, you see these things on Amazon all the time. You know, this title will be available in 2 months. You can order it now. And that's kind of the way it works.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's also interesting in so much as, I mean, the internet has pretty much killed any form of record sales and, in fact, traditional record companies. I mean, when we did actually sign our deal with Chrysalis Records, we were signed for 3 albums initially. Mm-hmm. And that was standard at the time. You know, they would sign an act, and they wouldn't necessarily expect your first record to be a hit. They were willing to give you time to develop, and they were willing to put the money and the effort in to make that happen. Because they saw something in you. I mean, obviously, we were a slightly different case in so much as we'd already had a hit record. But, that was commonplace with bands they would sign. And not just Chrysalis, it was across the business. And these days, even if you can find a record label that are willing to put money into a band, it really is very much, well, you'll get one record, and if it hits, great. If it doesn't, well, nice to have known you.
Yeah.
And like I said, you know, the internet has killed the sales of records, simply because, again, once things became digitally available and you can make a digital copy and put it on the internet, so you can release an album at 9 a.m. on the Monday morning, somebody can buy that album, and by 9:30 there's a perfect copy of it available for everybody in the world to just download for free.
Yeah.
So basically it's you know, suddenly I remember the home taping is killing music campaign in the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it really wasn't. I mean, basically that was, you know, you got a pretty poor copy of an album on a cassette. And if you liked it, you'd generally go and buy the album. But with this, it's a perfect copy. So it's effectively theft, but everybody seems to see it as a victimless crime. Of course, the victims are the musicians and the people who rely on them for work.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a sad indictment, isn't it, of where the music industry's gone. And of course, you haven't got, you know, the charts in the same conventional set way that you had before. You know, you mentioned Top of the Pops before. You know, we don't have that anymore, do we?
They've now divided the charts up by genre and stuff, which, you know, in a way is kind of fairer in terms of, because again, you know, we'd put an album out. I mean, in the case of the Nobody's Heroes record, our second album, we were given a midweek placing, I think, of number 2 or something.
Yeah.
And then you find by the time the actual chart comes out at the weekend, you're actually slipped to number 8 because 5 greatest hits albums, or now that's what I call music style albums, have gone above you. And it's kind of, well, you're not competing against like for like. It's not apples for apples. You're up against, you know, Rod Stewart's greatest hits. Well, of course, that's going to sell more than, you know, an album of new music by a relatively unknown band. So, you know, again, it has there's two sides to every story, as always. And the splitting of the charts into genres actually meant that, bizarrely, with our last studio album, we actually got our first number one record. You know,
yes, I saw that. Yeah, No Going Back got number 1, didn't it, in the BBC World?
Yeah, so, you know, that's great in terms of being gratifying. But it doesn't actually really mean a lot. I mean, it's one of those bizarre things. You always, you know, again, like I said, you think back to your 16-year-old self, and you try to imagine, how would you react if you ever had a number one record? Well, of course, by the time I rolled around to getting it, I was well into my 50s, and we just laughed. I mean, we just thought it was funny.
Didn't mean the same at all, did it? Isn't it strange?
No, not really. But it's still a nice thing to have on your CV, you know.
So. Yes, oh, absolutely. It's another achievement, isn't it? You've ticked it off the list.
Yes. Exactly.
I mean, obviously now then, you've obviously got, you know, touring, which is the most important thing, really, in terms of getting your name out there now, isn't it? And you've got your tour on the go, and you've got quite a few dates booked in. So what's coming up for you then, Jake?
Basically more touring. I mean, to be honest with you, it's the part of the business that I enjoy the most. I mean, the travelling is a bit of a bind, but, you know, that's... and I don't mean, you know, the going to places. Once we actually get to places, it's fantastic because, you know, again, I'm hugely privileged. I'm 60 years old next year, and I still get, people still pay me to travel the world for free. And I get, you know, I get paid for it when I get there, you know, which is just incredible.
Great.
And I also love the interaction with the audience. I love the instant reaction. I mean, I enjoy making records, but you have to wait a long time for, you know, for any sort of reaction to see if people actually liked what you did. Whereas when you start in front of an audience, it's a living, breathing thing. You know, it's instant reaction, and it's not always instant good reaction, but it's instant reaction. You know. So yeah, and it's, you know, that's the thing I enjoy the most. So yeah, this tour, we finish, we would continue right through the end of the month in the UK, and then we've got, I think, about 10 days in Germany. So that takes us up to about the 10th of April. And so that's, that section finishes. Then after that, I believe, what's the next thing we're doing? Blimey, I know there's something.
Yes, now I know what you're going to be doing. You're going to be actually bringing out the 25th anniversary performance of Barrowlands, I believe. Is that the next
thing? Well, that's actually already there. That's already come out to the pledge. To the people who pledged for it, they've already got that. But yes, that will be coming out to the general public eventually in the next few months. Then we've got some festivals in the summer, I believe. We're doing a big show in Belfast for the, obviously we wanted to do something special at home. Yeah. For the 40th anniversary. So our friends the Stranglers are coming to play with us. The Ruts are coming to play with us, and local band the Outcasts, who formed at the same time we did, are rounding out the bill. So you know, that's a nice thing to do. I'm doing my first ever solo outing. I've been asked by the Dropkick Murphys and Rancid are doing a dual headline tour of America. Late July, early August, and they very kindly asked me and said, you know, do you want to bring a guitar and come along and do half an hour every night before we play? And I thought, and the thing is, I used to drink quite a lot. I don't drink anything like as much as I used to, and they picked the one night I'd had a few to phone me and ask me this. And of course, sort of, you know, one glass of red wine too many, and I went, yeah, that sounds like fun, I'll do it. Of course, the next morning the reality of it hits you and you think, God, I've never actually stood on a stage on my own before.
That's a new experience, isn't it, for you?
And you know, these are not small bands. I mean, they're going to be playing to between 7,000 and 10,000 people a night. So the thought of going out on a stage in front of 10,000 rabid punk rockers and me with a little acoustic guitar and playing, also playing some of our songs in a ballad style, I instantly started to back out of it, and my wife was like, oh, you'll be fine, stop moaning.
Oh, with all your experience, you will be fine, Jake. I can't believe for 1 minute it won't go well, but it must be, actually, you'll feel like you're naked, won't you, on stage? That's the only problem.
It is, I mean, yeah, to be out on my own is kind of, you know, at least in a band, you can always look and, you don't blame somebody else when something goes wrong, but if you screw up on your own, it's kind of obvious who did it, you know.
Yes, it does a bit, doesn't it? Oh, look, that sounds absolutely wonderful, Jake. So I wish you all the best with that. I wish you best with the physical fingers, obviously, but also with your solo naked tour, which I
think that's pretty much what it is.
And thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been an absolute pleasure. It's been an absolute pleasure. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Cattails. To listen again to this and other tales, go to cattails.co.uk.